I remember Joe, because the way it worked is that Bob would come right in the morning, and he'd say hello to everybody and give them a little pep talk. Then he would leave it, and Dennis and Nancy Lee and I would run the program, and Bob would show back up at the end, you know, just when everybody was done, and say, "Well, how'd everybody do?" and talk, and you know, have a little thing at the end. So I remember Joe very well. I think Joe was a little disappointed that he had to deal with a couple of 20-something-year-olds, you know, and not Bob Monroe for the whole weekend. But in any case, that's the way it was run. Well, we found out pretty soon that 20 rooms wasn't enough. And then I put Dennis and Bill Yost and I back in the garage, building now a portable audio harness that could play to 30, I think maybe 40 people. We are started renting large conference rooms in hotels, taking all the furniture out. The hotel people wondered, what were we doing? The table went out, the chairs went out, everything, and we would have, it'd be a room like this room, and we'd have aisles, and then we'd have bodies laid out all over the floor. You know, and every 2 or 3 feet there'd be another body laying out on the floor, and they all had to come with their own mats, and or if they didn't have a mat, they just laid on the floor. And we put this wiring harness down the middle of the aisles and peeled off the earphones and so on to everybody. And again, you know, it was Dennis and Nancy Lee and Tom that ran the seminars, and Bob would come in at the beginning and he'd come in at the end. So we did this and ran a whole bunch of those. At that time, the demand kept growing. Pretty soon, it was we needed a way to do this off-site, not just here in the Charlottesville area, but off-site. Now, this new land hadn't happened yet. We weren't here where we are today. We were still at Whistlefield Farm, was the headquarters of all of this. And so we started to go on the road. We'd pack up that harness, and Nancy Lee and I would go off to California and do a seminar, and Nancy Lee and Dennis would go off to the Northeast and do a seminar. And so it went until Dennis and I, with full-time jobs and full-time families, you know, and now being trainers besides on the road, was just more than we could stand. So at that point, Dennis and I started to kind of back out and look for replacements. And Bob took a little chance to kind of stop and rest and see what he was going to do next with it, because it was obvious he had something that was going to work. So shortly after then that Bob purchased this new land, a place where he could build a facility. And other people came in. Dennis and I kind of slipped out the back. Now, I was still on the board and still interfaced a little bit here, but then that was kind of the end of my tenure with it. But so that was the invention, if you will, of Hemi-Sync and of TMI. Those things came later. Bob patented that binaural beat sound as Hemi-Sync, and that was his name that he chose for it. And eventually, of course, the organization got changed a couple of times, and until finally it ended up as TMI over here on on the new land. Okay, so that's it for the history lesson. That's where Hemi-Sync and TMI came from. Now let's do a little physics and a little metaphysics, and I'll try to give you a quick rundown about what the nature of reality looks like. Okay, and I'm very likely to break some of your favorite paradigms. Well, we're one ahead, but that's all right, I'll get there. Very, very likely to break some of your paradigms. I'm very likely to run over a few of your most cherished cultural, personal, scientific beliefs. But instead of believing or disbelieving what I say, just consider the possibilities and assess the probability based on your own experience. Use open-minded skepticism until you find out. You must develop your own personal big picture from your own personal experience. Until it's your personal experience, it cannot be your truth. Okay, so always remain both open-minded and skeptical. If you are not open-minded, you'll never learn anything new. If you're not skeptical, you'll never know whether what you're experiencing is real or made up. Okay, so you must be both. Okay, now we're going to look at some big picture models. Big picture model has to describe everything, objective and subjective, physics and metaphysics, the normal and the paranormal. Today I'm going to explain big picture science, and I will show you that the big picture science derives little picture science as well as metaphysics. Okay, to be valuable, big picture science must provide a superset, must provide better, more complete physics, and better, more complete metaphysics. First, a historical perspective. Albert Einstein, the last 25 years of his career, he worked on a thing called unified field theory. This was going to be a TOE. TOE means theory of everything. And what that means was that one understanding, one set of principles in which he could derive all of science, just from one principles. And really what he was interested in, he wanted one set of principles that could derive both quantum mechanics and relativity. Those were the two big new things in science, and they didn't look like they went together. They were kind of separate things off doing their own thing, and he knew there must have been something more general understanding from which you could derive both, and that's what he wanted. And that actually boiled down to just finding out two things. One, why was the velocity of light a constant? Because that's the key to developing relativity. Once you understand that light's constant, relativity just falls out with a little algebra. Okay, and the second was, why should particles really not be particles, but be probability distributions? Because once you understand that, then quantum mechanics falls out very naturally with a little algebra. So those were his issues. Now I'm going to do some quotes to let you know where Albert Einstein ended up. After 25 years of studying the larger reality from his view, what were his conclusions? Okay, space does not have an independent existence. It's a quote from Albert Einstein. Reality is merely an illusion. Okay, hence it's clear that in the space of physics, that the space of physics is not, in the last analysis, anything given in nature or independent of human thought. It's a function of our conceptual scheme. Space, which is our reality, is a function of mind. Now, this is Albert Einstein. This isn't some New Age guy, you know, with long hair on the street corner. Well, he had long hair, but still wasn't a New Age guy. This was Albert Einstein, probably one of the most competent and far-reaching scientists who knew how to think out of the box. And these were his conclusions. Okay. Now, David Bohm, another physicist, very highly respected, worked with Albert Einstein. So, you know, he had to be highly respected to work with the best of the best. The thing he said was, our notions of consciousness must have room in them to understand what it means for its content to be reality as a whole. Okay? Consciousness has to contain reality as a whole. Again, these are physicists, very, you know, the top of the top. They had a problem. They knew that consciousness was at the root. That was fundamental. But they just didn't know what to do about it. They were stuck. All right, we know that. Now what? Well, here's a letter from Einstein to Bohm, written on October 28, 1954. One has to find a possibility to avoid the continuum, together with space and time altogether. But I have not the slightest idea what kind of elementary concepts could be used in such a theory. See, they were just stuck. Now, coming from a different direction, quantum mechanics produced an even stranger view of reality. Okay, and I'm going to run through why quantum mechanics came to be. Quantum mechanics existed because of this experiment. It's a very famous experiment, and it's called the double-slit experiment. For many years, scientists knew that if you put light through two slits in a barrier, that you would get this diffraction pattern. What would happen is some of the light would go through this slit, some of the light would go through this slit, and then the light would interfere with each other. The way it interfered is that the distance between here and that point and the distance between here and that point from the two slits had to be some integral number of wavelengths so that the wavelengths got there in phase. And when they did, you'd get some light. And when they didn't, when they got out of phase, you got nothing. You got dark spots in between them. Okay, so this was an experiment well known, done many times, diffraction grating. And then Einstein came along and studied the light hitting things and knocking out electrons, okay? Yeah, photoelectric effect. He was studying that, and he realized that light looked like a particle. It seemed to always have some integer number of chunks of momentum. It came with little chunks of momentum, just like particles. So he said, light's a particle, and his theory supported that. Well, now that made a big question. Well, if light's a particle, particles, we know, you know, they go through slits. They just travel in straight lines unless interacted on by an exterior force, right? Newton told us that. And they would put a little spot of light behind that slit and a little spot of light behind that spot. That's what a particle would do. So if light's particles, you know,